Montreal since 1987.
Canada, this is the doctor.
Yo, this is Slim Kid.
This is Fat Lip.
This is Imani.
This is the Far Side.
That's who we are. Yo, check it out. We're just chilling. You know what I'm saying? Yo, Imani, what station are we on? CKUT
90.3
FM. Cool.
Today on Wings, Mindy Ran shares excerpts from her 2024 interview with Max Dashut, creator, curator, and director of the unique and astonishingly comprehensive Suppressed Histories Archives.
When I began doing slideshows back in 73, 74, women would come up and say over and over again, why don't we know about this?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Max Dashut was born in 1950, grew up in the U.S. state of Illinois, won a scholarship to Harvard University, and started there in 1968, a year of intense social and political revolution. Appalled by the sexism of the institution, Dashut says she quit school but kept her library card. After saving some money by working at an agriculture factory, she came back to Cambridge and started her own research. By 1970, she had founded what would become the Suppressed Histories Archives, where she collects, organizes, presents, and teaches the evidence of women's roles, culture, and experiences in history and prehistory. It's been described as a hybrid of academic research and popular education. Here's Mindy Ran.
2024 is the 54th year of the Suppressed Histories Archives, the brainchild and life's work of renowned feminist historian Max Dashut. The archives consist of over 50,000 interdisciplinary slides, documents, and images. They cover global women's history, indigenous orature, and anti-colonial, anti-patriarchal narratives. I asked Dashut how this lifetime's work began.
When I moved back to Cambridge, I went home and worked in my agricultural factory for a couple months to get some money back together after I left Harvard. And at that time, I did not think I was founding an archive. I just knew that in order to uncover women's history, I had to have evidence, because it was literally a joke at that time. So I needed to pile up documentation for any statement I wanted to make. I knew it would be challenged. And so I had to have, you know, either written materials, and then later on, a lot of it is visual, especially all pre-literate societies or non-literate societies. You know, you're looking at iconography as a main line of evidence. And so women's history is necessarily very interdisciplinary. And of course, this is all pre-digital, pre-internet. So we're looking at card catalogs, you know, and there's a whole bias to the way that the information was organized and constructed. Card catalog, women, housewife, fashion, you know, this kind of stuff, motherhood, not to diss motherhood, but it was just, you know, there were these conceptual ghettos that women were locked into. So it took a long time for me to track down where the evidence could be found, even. And there was a whole issue about the way knowledge is organized in Western Civ, in the libraries, because Indigenous history was not found in history sections, or very rarely, but it would be found in ethnography under the anthropology header. And, you know, this is where the orature, if it was written about at all, that's where you would find it. So there were all these biases. For example, one idea I began with is that it would be more likely to find egalitarian social structures in indigenous societies than in imperial ones. I mean, that's just, you know, you're dealing with class-ranked societies. We already know that the empires are patriarchal. We could look at European or Chinese or, you know, all the different colonial systems of domination that are in history, and they're all patriarchal. But what about the other end? And you can't assume either that indigenous means that it's not patriarchal. You just have to really look in there and find out what's there. For example, you know, in a matrilocal society, women are at the center. They're structurally at the center. And this gives supports to women as the child bearers to be near their kin, near their support systems. It means you don't have homeless children. And so there are consequences. It's not neutral.
Would you say these archives are a reflection of the way your brain works?
Well, maybe to some degree, but, you know, I was really just canvassing the libraries and looking. I felt like I had to really understand everything. I mean, initially I was looking for matriarchies because I had heard this anthropologist say, well, you know, it doesn't matter if there's matrilineal societies because all societies are male dominated. And I didn't know what was out there. I had to learn a lot. And so I'm not only looking at the indigenous cultures, but I'm also trying to see where are the regions in the world that are not dominated by imperial states, by standing armies, by resource extraction from others, you know, enslavement and so forth. And, you know, hoping that egalitarianism would also be reflected in sex, which, you know, for anthropology, a lot of time when they talk about egalitarian society, sex does not enter into it. This has historically been true. It may have changed to some degree, but, you know, it's just kind of left off the boards. What happens to women so often is disregarded. So the central organizing principle of the archives was to find out where are the women and what's happening to them? What's their standing? What's their situation? How much liberty do they have? Choice, self-determination. So there's a lot of questions on the table. And, you know, the lines of evidence, too, because we have, okay, there's the written history, and that's very limited, being from male elites, primarily, shaping most of what we have for ancient times. You know, the inscriptions in stone, that's not something that has to do with peasant women, unless it's their enslavement. But we have to look at the deep history now. We're getting more and more. First, it was ethnolinguistics and the study of language families, which showed us movements of peoples and interrelations between peoples. Now we have the genome research, which is showing us also very deep levels of human history before anything is recorded. We have archaeology, and so we can look at ancient temples or village sites and see how things are organized. Sometimes there's long houses and there's a more collective organization. There is also indigenous orature, very important, because those are primary sources. It's very different, you know, in the universities, a primary source used to be, well, you know, this was written by, you know, the Jesuit relations were written in Eastern Canada by a French priest. And so that's a primary source because it's an original source. But he's writing, and you know, that particular source is really valuable in talking about the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations of the Iroquois, five nations at that time, because he's saying nothing is more real than the superiority of the women. I don't think that would be an Iroquoian point of view. That was a French patriarchal point of view, because it isn't really a dominance-based society, especially as the sexes are concerned. But that was his perception of a culture that was so profoundly different than his own, which was based on superiors and inferiors. So you kind of have to read through those so-called primary sources. But the real primary sources are the oral keepings, as they call them. You know, the Great Law of Peace, for example, encoding matrilineage, and the mothers, they are the guardians of the soil. So this is an oral code of law that was very developed before the English and French colonists came in. Over the 54 years since I've been doing this, a lot has happened, because more and more we are seeing books by indigenous people about their own traditions, and indigenous women especially, which is very often the very hardest thing to find. It's a long known critique of anthropological method, is that they made assumptions based on only what the men told them, and they didn't have any input from the women or any idea of authority that women might have in those cultures.
Do you feel that this need to be so precise came up out of your experience in Harvard?
Look, I rebelled against that, actually, and I lost some important documentations because there was a period of time I just thought it's all patriarchal. It's all, you know, domination-based, and so who cares, you know, what the source was. And then I was disabused of that by Indigenous people who were saying, well, what's your source for that? So, you know, it's like, okay, even if the source is very problematic, part of the thing is we have to do a critique. But I'd say more that my desire has been to undo not only the patriarchal scripts, but also the colonial scripts. And without a critique of the sources we're using from that standpoint, garbage in, garbage out, basically, you have to be able to be aware of the biases in order to get a true picture, or as close to one as we can manage.
This really is a life's work.
What I'm doing is provisional. Because of the suspicion I have around sources, that's part of it. There are huge gaps that we may never be able to fill about whole areas of the planet. But what information comes in, often I find like there'll be part of a juicy quote, and I didn't really know until years later that the secondary source I got that quote from left out some of the most significant information. And then, you know, maybe 20, 30 years later, I'd find the rest of the quote, and it's like, oh, there's more. And so there's this process of deeming unimportant or being threatened by causing the sources you're working with to withhold information. They just didn't see it as significant because it wasn't about kings and chiefs and rulers, generals. And it was just, you know, the old village woman who was in charge of the ceremony, whatever it may be. And I have to modify my information as corrections come in.
On Wings, you're listening to Max Dashew, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, speaking to Mindy Ran. A great deal of Dashew's work has been collecting and contextualizing visual imagery, creating many, many slideshows and videos for public presentations and courses.
I'm trying to gather together all of the cultural testimony, and that includes written, archaeological, iconographic, so there's all the ancient female figurines or perhaps wooden statues, and looking at them also as reflections about something about how the society sees women. Very often ancestral women come into this, not only goddesses, as many of us assumed, but, you know, when you look at Indigenous cultures and you see the importance of ancestors, then the grandmothers becomes one line of interpretation for those ancient figurines, going all the way back to the Paleolithic. So in the sexist standard anthropological interpretation, then it would be, well, you know, these are sex objects, you know, from the standpoint of the male gaze. And then, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, these are mature women. They're large women, you know, long hanging breasts, folds of fat. They are very different from what our society thinks about as sex objects. But, you know, that just even to jump to that as an interpretation leaves out so many other realities. So what patterns emerge when you look at this in a global way? Because, you know, most of us are more exposed to the European figurines, but then there are those in the Nile Valley. There are some which have turned up in the Sahara, which is a very, very ancient reservoir of culture that has got not nearly enough attention to it historically. Some amazing rock paintings that are quite, quite ancient. Like, we're talking in a range of 8,000 to 4,000 BCE for some of these Algerian and Libyan rock paintings. That's cultural testimony. You know, some of it's daily life, and other times it's ceremony. And you can't necessarily tell. Like, there's a famous, the Lady of Aurangzeb in the Tassili Nazir. This running woman, but she's dressed in ceremonial regalia, and she has these fringes, long streamers bound around her arms and her lower legs. And her body is stippled with these dotted patterns. You know, they could be scarification, they could be tattoos, they could be body paint, but they seem to represent some kind of idea of numinous energy inherent in her. And then on her head is this long crescent that looks like animal horns. Some people see it as a lunar crescent. And so there's many interpretations of this image, and we can't tell, is this meant to be a medicine woman in ceremony? Is this a goddess? Is this an ancestral woman for a particular clan? And we're never going to know. That's the just the nature of this archaeological beast, is that there's such a long break in time distance from that period. Who knows who the descendants of those people are that made that painting? So, you know, that's often, there's this interpretative break where we just can't say without other contextual information. Maybe some archaeological sites do show a female figurine occurring within a shrine. Context is a lot, but unfortunately, my sources, as I'm reading a lot of these archaeological excavation reports back in the 70s, you'd be lucky to find a photo. It wouldn't necessarily even have a site name on it because it was not deemed important. And, you know, all these female figurines, maybe they are sex symbols, maybe they are fertility idols, which continues to be a really stereotypical framing that is a favorite among archaeologists even now after all these years. Or maybe they are concubines or dancing girls. There's just all these insulting interpretations. And especially the older sources don't give the importance to the female iconography to tell you what was the fine context.
On Wings, Max Dashew, founder of the Suppressed Histories Archives, is speaking to Wings reporter Mindy Ran.
What I'm curious about is the suppressed histories. Mm-hmm. How do you find and what do you define as suppressed histories? I mean, if they've been suppressed or destroyed, how do you piece them back together?
Right. I mean, suppressed can take a lot of forms. So you do have a lot of goddess statues from Western Asia, the Mediterranean, different parts of the world, whose faces have been smashed. You know, broken noses, you know, deliberate defacement, literal defacement of goddesses, of pagan icons. And you certainly see under Christian and Islamic regimes, and earlier the Judaic regime, a persecution of these older forms of culture by the new dominant religion. So that's a direct suppression. And that would also include book burnings, destruction of previous dynasties sometimes also takes that form. If you go through Egypt, you'll see a lot of the reliefs have been attacked. Some of them look like they threw chains at them or chiseled out these irregular patterns, especially directed to the face. So that's a direct suppression, especially of women. It's not to say there are no male gods that have never been defaced. Goddesses are a particular target, especially in these Abrahamic attacks on systems that were polytheistic and who had female deities, great mothers or whatever. And so, for example, the veneration of Isis, you had the archbishops of Cairo and Alexandria going around and searching out the secret shrines that people had built behind a wall so that they could continue their devotions, because simply because the state decreed Christianity as the only legal religion didn't mean people all of a sudden just went, yeah, okay, now we're Christian. You know, they continued. And there's much, much evidence of that in various countries, of the extreme conservationism, not conservatism, but the desire to keep beloved cultural forms. I think that my concept of suppression also extends to this kind of blinkered view, this attempt to sort of to either omit deliberately or through disregard, through discounting. You have gatekeeping at multiple levels in the publishers, in, you know, what the books get titled, what gets edited out from the books, and then also what books fall out of publication. One way you can see this in the Greek world is that the Sappho is one of the that famous lesbian poet. Her work survived because it was beloved even by men, but we don't have her complete works the way we do with Apollodorus or others, so that the male bibliophiles and the collectors, you know, when they were fleeing maybe from an invasion or, you know, a fire, whatever, what books did they take with them? Or what books did they acquire in the first place? So there's a constant attrition, like particles sifting down to the floor of the ocean. The works of female authors who did exist in lesser numbers always, but they were there, get lost. They get swept away. they get forgotten. And so there's that kind of suppression as well. It isn't necessarily conscious of we want to get rid of this, but this devaluing and failure to preserve that happens.
Do the archives include, you've been talking a lot about ancient histories, are they also brought through to today?
Oh, yes. Yes. I see patriarch as a historical process, and there's layers and layers and accretions that build up. There's a very wide range of patrilineal societies, including some of the indigenous cultures, that they weren't as bad as the Romans. They were patrilineal. You know, you have to sort of make distinctions between the actual standing of women and the degree of self-determination they had. So that varies a lot, even inside patriarchal or patrilineal systems.
I was caught by a comment about the suppressed histories, which said that you are including narratives of women who were central to events, but often left out of mainstream accounts. How do you find those back?
Yeah, that's the hard part. You know, you have to read a lot. And I just have my antenna always poised. So here's an example. The first international spectrum show I created was Women in Power. Just looking at female spheres of power across the world, including in patriarchal societies. Because you do find cultures where women are dominated within the family structure, but they may still be very powerful, like in the marketplace, or they may, especially spiritual spheres of power, priestesses and female oracles and healers and medicine women are something that you will see happening. Like, for example, in medieval Europe, deeply patriarchal society, and yet there were certain women who were respected as healers and herbalists. So you find these persistences happening. But anyway, within that show, I noticed that the women who were in revolutionary movements, indigenous resistance against colonization, there was a pattern there of them being spiritual leaders of some kind. And that these women, because of that spiritual prestige that they had, wound up leading these revolts against colonization. So I started a new presentation on that. At first, I think I had like 38 slides. That was the starting point. But now I have too many for a 90-minute presentation. It's a definite pattern. And so you have women like Wanan Hucha. She was descended from Tanzanians who had been taken out in the Swahili slave trade and trafficked up to Somalia. So she led an exodus, basically. Very much as Harriet Tubman did, for that matter. And she was also a visionary, a dreamer. So, but Wanan Hucha was a Nganga, which is a Bantu name for the medicine people and the diviners. And there's just countless, countless instances of that. The heritages we have, there's just all kinds of riches. There are the women drummers in Eritrea and various parts of Africa. There are the medicine women who are healers, which who are still going along in spite of all of this. There are ceremonial leadership of women in the Candomblé religion, this Afro-Brazilian religion, and so many other traditions. Women are recouping some of our losses. That's happening as well. Big movements inside of Native North America to revalue the women and, you know, the work that the women do and the leadership of women. And so these are all developments that are going on, you know, this recovery, or as they're calling it, rematriation. So here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Ohlone Nation, women elders founded a land trust to attempt to reestablish a land base from all of the territory that was stolen from them during the genocidal gold rush. These are all things that are happening. And from my standpoint, just even the recovery of all this cultural heritage, I feel like, yes, women are demoralized. We're intended to be demoralized by all this backlash. They want us intimidated. But when you look at this whole swath of cultural achievements and the treasures in the archaeology or even in the photographic record, things that are buried away and hidden, but nevertheless, there they are. You know, these women who discovered hydrogen or whatever. I think of the Suppressed Histories Archives as bringing medicine to women for our spirits, because we do get so beat down and so discouraged. And you look around and you see all of this, I can't use that word on the air. You know, we do have these heritages and we have been powerful and we are still powerful. And there are things being done which are not getting publicity, which are really, really crucial by women or by anybody who supports egalitarian and cooperative culture. You know, we have to turn away from the aggression and towards the cooperative and away from the authoritarian, which has really become increasingly dominant in U.S. politics.
I ask you if what you did is social archaeology.
We also say, you know, it's historical recovery work. I mean, there's a lot of ways we could describe it, but we need this knowledge and we need the images. That's why I teach with images, because to see it is different. You feel it when you see the picture of the Chilean machi, the medicine woman, beating on her cultrún and leading ceremony for a whole community of people in southern Chile. It's just inspiring to see this. And when I began doing slideshows back in 73, 74, women would come up and say over and over again, why don't we know about this? How come we never see any of this? It was not shown to us. It was withheld. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. I just think it's more of a tendency that it was either dismissed at one end or it was deliberately omitted because it was subversive to the patriarchal order. And so we recover it, we get it back. And it really helps that we have our digital platforms to do that with, you know, and we can find the Choctaw herbalists who are still among us and the granny healers in Appalachia and all of these things. I've been working on the goddess religion. There was this big goddess resurgence in Vietnam after the American War. And people were going back to very old matricultural roots and very much integrating it with their modern lives. So it can be quite surprising sometimes to see what bubbles up once the chains are taken off.
And these archives are open access.
Well, the physical archives is not. My whole project is to get as much of it out in digital form as I can. So currently there's the website. We have to overhaul the website. I have migrated 14 years worth of daily posts on Facebook, photo essays that I put up. They're on the site, but I need to create navigation pages so people can access them. So that's the next big step, is to get more available and get it tagged by content so people can search. And if they're looking for African priestesses, they can find that. If they're looking for the archaeology of East Asia, they can find that. Birth, women warriors, all these different categories.
That was Max Dashew on the Suppressed Histories Archives. This is Mindy Ran in Amsterdam for Wings.
To find images and information from Max Dashew's 54 years of work on the Suppressed Histories Archives, visit the website suppressedhistories.net. That's suppressedhistories.net. To connect with Wings, visit the website wings.org or check facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events with diverse topics and speakers can be watched at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
CKUT's annual funding drive is back and taking place from March 15th to 24th, 2024. We have exciting new merch available for our donors, including t-shirts, tote bags, mugs, magnets, and posters. Thanks to the generosity of this year's sponsors, you'll get a chance to win goodies from your favorite local businesses, festivals, and more, with every donation $35 or above. This year's sponsors include Pop Montreal, Cinema Public, Constellation Records, Mutech, Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, Encore Books and Vinyl, RIDM, CNL Cycle, Adam Hart, Just Seeds, Lola Rosa, Cutting Edge, Drawn and Quarterly, Death of Vinyl, La Rama, La Seltzer, Dispensaire Microbrasserie, Luglion, Pizza Bouquet, and Paragraph Bookstore. CKUT would like to thank our sponsors for supporting another year of people-powered community radio. For more details on prizes and to donate, go to ckut.ca/donate.
Hi, this is Cyrus Chestnut, and you're listening to the greasiest, bluesiest, the delicacy, CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
The International Association of Women in Radio and Television, founded in 1949, promotes recognition, safety, and solidarity of women in journalism professions. For Women's History Month, here is a panel comprised of their members describing risks women journalists have faced for speaking truth to power.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Speaking Truth to Power was the theme of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television Conference held in Delhi, India in the fall of 2015. One panel there featured courageous women journalists who fight censorship in their own countries. Wings invited an Amsterdam-based radio producer and activist for women journalists to select excerpts from that event and put them in global context. Here's Mindy Ran.
Attacks on foreign correspondents may make world headlines, but recent research shows it's much more dangerous to be a local journalist who covers corrupt, repressive governments, criminal gangs, or big money interests. All the women you are about to hear take those kinds of risks. Their countries are officially democracies. They have constitutions and hold elections. They have both state and private media. But like a growing number of countries around the world, they also use threats and violence for media control.
We have currently more than 500 political prisoners in the country, and roughly half of them are women.
This is Ilang Ilang Quijano from the Philippines. She's the managing director and editor of a multimedia outlet for investigative journalism, Pinoy Weekly. She showed slides.
That's Sharon Cabusao. She was an officer of Gabriela, the women's movement in the Philippines. And she was our editor. And at the time of her arrest, she was also a researcher for a labor group. She's still under custody, even if they arrested her without warrant. She and her husband are detained in that small cell. It's really like a cell for dogs, you know. Another woman political prisoner, she's Andrea Rosal. She is the daughter of the late communist spokesperson. So they arrested her and they accused her of being a rebel, but her case was dismissed because they found no evidence. But what was the price? When she was arrested, she was pregnant. And then she gave birth in custody, but they didn't give her any medical attention. And what happened was her baby died. So really, it's worse than martial law, because in martial law, the older people tell us that, you know, in martial law, the women, they were always freed, you know, because of humanitarian reasons, all especially pregnant women.
The vulnerability of prisoners who are mothers is exemplified by Turkish journalist Arzu Yehildiz. In May 2016, she was sentenced to 20 months in prison for reporting on alleged Turkish arms shipments to Syria. The court also stripped her of her parental rights. As of August 2016, 68 journalists are imprisoned in Turkey. China, Egypt, Eritrea, and Syria are among the current hotspots for arrests of journalists and bloggers. Death is the ultimate form of silencing. One of many women journalists killed in the Philippines was Melinda Magsino.
This is an interesting case because she was a former journalist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. She was exposing the gambling activities of the governor of Batangas, the province she lives in. And in 2005, she went into hiding because of death threats. And then she retired from journalism. And then she got killed this year. They say that it's still because of the exposés that she did when she was a print journalist. And then when she was no longer a journalist, she continued exposing these through social media. The state forces usually try to deny that the killing is related to their work as a journalist. And they say that, oh, maybe it was because of a love angle, because she now has a new husband. For women, it's very difficult to be recognized as a journalist, even if you are killed, you know?
The worst massacre of journalists recorded to date was in the Philippines.
In the Ampatuan case, 58 people were killed. 32 of them were journalists. Some were human rights lawyers, others were civilians. The major perpetrator of the crime, it's like a warlord clan. One of them was already released on bail. And then 41 other police officers accused of the crime were released on bail. About 80 plus still remain at large. There are a total of 94 persons who were involved in the crime. And then witnesses. There have been 4 to 5 witnesses who have already been killed. The worst thing is the army officials who were involved in the massacre were promoted.
According to the International Federation of Journalists, over 2,200 journalists and media staff were killed between 1990 and 2016, 48 of them in the first half of 2016. In most cases, like the massacre in the Philippines, the vast majority of perpetrators have never been brought to trial.
It is very unfortunate in the Philippines that the killings of journalists continue under the current administration. And since 1986, there are like 174 journalists who have already been killed. So in 2013, the Philippines was ranked as the second most dangerous country for journalists, only next to Iraq. Since 1986, there have only been 11 convictions. Out of the 174 killings, only 11 convictions. And these are only the trigger men. No masterminds have ever been convicted.
That was Ilong Ilong Quijano, speaking on a panel of women journalists in September 2015. In June 2016, the incoming president of the Philippines was asked about the 176 journalists killed since his party came to power in 1986. He replied that many of them deserved to die. He went on to say, "The Constitution can't help you if you disrespect a person." Like the Philippines, the island country of Sri Lanka has ongoing ethnic and political conflicts. Their 25-year civil war officially ended in 2009, but the next government continued the power struggle through brutal media suppression.
The law seems to be of relevance to Sri Lanka, actually, for the last 5 years or so. Instead, what we had was complete and utter annihilation of the media.
Sri Lankan lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena.
The scores of killings in the northern and the eastern peninsula where the war actually took place has been legion. We have had censorship really being conformed from a matter of the law. The whole discussion and the whole struggle got transformed from that to a method of outright killings. And that transformation makes the very issue of censorship actually quite redundant. Because what do you do when, you know, your colleagues are killed? The pervasive fear that this leads to then chills every voice in the land. And I must also stress here the role played by the law in this regard. What happened was we had a whole plethora of military law, emergency law, Prevention of Terrorism Act, which were used to completely harass, intimidate, and censor journalists across the board. So at a point, you know, the military could walk into a printing press or into a publication house and just take over the entire house, take over the printing press. And nobody could challenge this in courts because the courts itself became an appendage of the political control and the political establishment. Courts also lost their independence. What was the point of my continuing in the country? It got to be so bad.
After the war ended, the president of Sri Lanka forbade investigation of war crimes and tightened his control on the media.
Pursuant to the ending of the conflict, Sri Lanka became worse. Because at least earlier we had the so-called excuse of a conflict to explain why the media was being censored or controlled. But pursuant to 2009, what happened was we had one political family controlling the entire government and controlling the entire working of the state apparatus in Sri Lanka, the Rajapaksas. The one brother was the president, all-powerful executive president. The other brother was the all-powerful secretary of defense. The other brother was the speaker of parliament. And we had scores of other relatives and cousins and whoever, you know, unknown of, unheard of people, you know, being heading all kinds of state and institutional mechanisms. And to put this in context, this was really quite unprecedented for Sri Lanka because we had had very long traditions of democracy, despite the fact that we had long-standing conflict in the country. We were not used to this kind of family aggrandizement, as it were. As a result of this transformation of the power of government, the media itself became more and more apathetic and less independent. So the state media, on the one hand, was completely taken over by the government, and we had propaganda to the extent that it was unimaginable, the state propaganda that took place. And the private media was also bought over by the Rajapaksa brothers. If you compare what the Indian media is and you compare the Sri Lankan media, you compare the Philippines media and you compare the Sri Lankan media. Sri Lanka is such a small country, you know. So when you have this corporate political control extending to almost every reach of the private media, you know, the extent to which the media collapsed in terms of its independence was enormous. On the one hand, we had this oppressive nature of the law, and then we had the method of killings and intimidation and complete fear being used by the government to censor and to threaten and control the media. And the self-censorship that took place was extremely high. There were, of course, exceptions to this rule. It was actually a joke during the repressive years that the voices speaking out against the government were really mostly women. It became quite interesting and quite amusing at a point that women commentators were actually being hailed as the people having the balls, so as to speak, in Sri Lanka. But though this picture was there of dominant female voices speaking out, in general, the control of the media was very much elite male-dominated. The presence of women, though they are in numbers, were not there in the managerial and editorial positions that one would expect. And in a sense, that lack of women editorial control was very well seen in the newsrooms and is still seen and has been the case for the last 3-4 decades, as it were.
One of the promises of the new government Sri Lanka elected in 2015 was that it would lift the bans that had been imposed against social media, especially websites of the Tamil minority. Bans on social media had not been effective in any case, as Jay Wardena explains.
We have had social media being used very effectively against the government during the last 5 years when the mainstream media could not function. In fact, social media was the reason why the Rajapaksa government was overthrown in January 2015, and also in August last month when, after years of going through this absolute terror, the Sri Lankan people overthrew this particular political family and brought in another government into power. And social media was a huge voice in that regard. But women, again, here did not play as prominent or as predominant a role as in the Philippines.
You are listening to lawyer and media columnist Kishali Pinto Jayawardena. She and other activists succeeded in getting a right to information law passed in Sri Lanka, and the previous government's website bans lifted. At the time she spoke to the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, she was skeptical that the new government of Sri Lanka would live up to its promises of media freedom. And indeed, since then, a requirement to register websites has been imposed. But she says it's not only up to the government to reform Sri Lankan media.
One of the most challenging tasks for us is to go beyond the law to see what is really wrong with us, with the media in its functioning and in its control. We have had a situation where an entire minority has been categorized as being second-class citizens in Sri Lanka by the media itself. The racism and the communalism prevalent on the part of the mainstream media has been astounding. We need to look inwards at the media and not look only at the state as a reason or as the fount or the origin of censorship.
On Wings, you are listening to voices recorded in Delhi, India, at the 36th Biennial Conference of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. The theme of the conference was Speaking Truth to Power. Here again is producer and activist for women journalists, Mindy Ran.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, there were 232 journalists jailed around the world in 2012. More than half of them were sentenced under anti-terrorist laws. Continued expansion of these laws creates convenient cover for punishing journalists and forcing them to reveal their sources. But older laws are also getting brought back into play against journalists. Among these are libel, defined as a published false statement that is damaging to a person's reputation. And also sedition, which was defined in the 19th century as conduct or language inciting rebellion against a lawful government. Colonial-era sedition and seditious libel laws are still being used against journalists and netizens in India, Tanzania, Nigeria, Malaysia, and other former colonies of Britain and France. These kinds of charges can easily be corrupted to try and block criticisms of officials and companies, and they are very difficult to fight. Ilang Ilang Kihano, her father, and four other journalists were charged with criminal libel in 2004. It took them 12 years to beat the charge. Kihano's father is a physician and a professor of pharmacology and toxicology at the University of the Philippines. His research had shown that pesticides used on bananas were poisoning workers. Ilang Ilang Kihano.
I was not arrested. I turned myself in for bail because they tried to arrest my father. Me and then the editors of the paper, we paid 10,000 pesos for bail. And not many people have that kind of money. And we never got the bail back, you know, even if the charges were dismissed. And the case dragged on for 12 years. And we spent around 500,000 pesos defending ourselves for what was obviously a harassment case by a plantation. Because the evidence is very clear, you know, health poisoning, the people were getting sick, the environment was getting destroyed, and we had pictures, we had interviews, it was very well documented. And yet, the case dragged on for 12 years. It was actually dismissed by the lower court, but the owner of the company was a minister, agriculture minister, and during his time, he had the ruling reversed. It drained our resources. Of course, there are many NGOs helping us, but even ordinary citizens or journalists who are sued with libel, I wonder how can they cope with such harassment suits. In the Philippines, it's really used to harass. And then the worst thing that happened is that instead of decriminalizing libel, they actually added another form, which is online libel. The funny thing is they call it the Cyber Crime Prevention Act. And originally, it was supposed to penalize crimes that had to do with things like protecting women's and children's rights. And the thing is, it was passed without public consultation. So from before, it was 6 months, the minimum. Now it's like 6 years, and the maximum is 12 years of imprisonment.
Quijano gave examples of how the new law was abused.
See this woman in my picture. She's a teacher who just posted on social media about the mining companies, Taiwanese and Chinese mining companies, whom the mayor was involved with, and the mayor sued her, and she got detained overnight. Some nurses in Taguig who were complaining about how the hospital was being run, they were fired from their jobs. Liking a libelous post or in sharing a libelous post on Facebook means that you're aiding and abetting the crime. And they even had a takedown clause wherein if the Department of Justice sees reasonable cause for the website to be shut down, that was the takedown provision. And also it allowed for the collection of real-time data, metadata. But these clauses, these really draconian, you know, clauses, they were struck down by the Supreme Court. So that was an initial victory. And it's only because that people, the media, they really fought.
Quijano is one of the new generation of journalists who are creating their own multimedia outlets online.
We are the ones who would be the primary victims of this law because we believe that the repression of the medium is the message.
Women speaking out online, whether as journalists, bloggers, or activists, often experience abuse by trolls. Dr. Anya Kovacs directs the Internet Democracy Project in Delhi, India.
There was a case very recently of a woman called Preeta PG, who has about 17,000 followers on Facebook. She's from Kerala, a South Indian state, and she writes a lot about political issues. Sometime in July, she made some comments criticizing a Kerala politician for sexist comments he had been making. As a consequence, faced a lot of abuse. Her profile was temporarily taken down by Facebook. She managed to get that restored. Once it was restored, the former president of India, Dr. Kalam, died, who she then criticized again on Facebook, again became the victim of massive hate. There were hate pages created just to attack her. There was a page created to claim that she was a prostitute. Her son is disabled and was pulled into this as well. There were a whole number of women who responded, so she got quite a lot of online support against all of this. But about a week later, the hate pages were still on. Preeta's own page was taken down, and the profiles of a lot of the women who supported her were taken down as well. Aspects about this incident say a lot about the landscape of free speech in general. First of all is the way in which mob violence or social pressure groups can actually impose censorship without even having to use the law. It was very clear that the people who attacked Preeta did so on political grounds, and that that was why she was silenced. The second thing is that the law and police often doesn't really help. Yesterday, I came to know about journalists of Khabar Lahariya, which is a rural newspaper from Uttar Pradesh run by marginalized women, that they have been harassed on mobile phone by a stalker for about 2 months now, with multiple calls from different numbers on a daily basis. And the only thing that the police did was pass around the phone in the police station so that different policemen could talk to the abuser and basically have a joke. And the third issue is about the response of Facebook as an internet intermediary, one of the companies that actually controls a lot of these spaces. Interesting in Preeta's case is that she was not writing in English. She was writing in Malayali, a language that most people in Kerala speak and which also has a different script. Facebook claims to have community moderators, but clearly they didn't find what was going on the hate pages problematic in any way. Preeta was told that this does not violate community standards. Facebook said, because it does not come under international hate speech regulation, we cannot take it down. So the community standards basically became international law, which sees hate speech as being based on religion, nationality, and ethnic background, right? but doesn't recognize neither gender, nor disability, nor sexual orientation. Facebook refused to create a safe space for Preeta, but the profiles of Preeta and her friends were all taken down on the grounds that they did not use their real name. Preeta's last name that's on her birth certificate is not PG, it's a caste name. Using your caste name can have wider ramifications for political activists from lower castes in particular, which you do not necessarily want to face. Preeta has been in touch with Facebook, and after a lot of discussing, her profile has now been restored. She doesn't have to use her caste name for now. But the whole case raises really important questions about who Facebook will hear. The women started a campaign, so there's a hashtag for a better Facebook, both on Facebook and on Twitter, to highlight how Facebook restricts women's speech on purely commercial grounds because it's easier for them to sell advertisements if they can profile you across many different platforms. It was really interesting to see how in no time, women from across South Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East, started to say exactly the same thing. Facebook has been hearing voices from women of the West to some extent and responded to some of the issues that they face. But even in Western countries, trans women face issues with the real name policy. Native American women had been facing issues because their names were not recognized as real names by the Facebook community keepers.
One of the experiences we've had in Kenya is that when women feel violated online, instead of fighting back for their space, they actually get off the online spaces.
Rachel Nakatari, past president of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV.
One of the things we had to do was to train the police, but the police themselves are not sensitized. In fact, in Kenya, for example, we do not have very specific laws that address issues of cybersecurity. And so even when you report to the police, they're helpless. So one of the things that we have actually tried to do is to partner with the police now and get experts to train them. Because when we try to have an interview with the internet service providers, the Google, they say their allegiance is first to the customer, say they do not want to deal with the activists. They want to protect the people, you know, who are then abusing you online. So it becomes very tricky. And one of the biggest challenges that we've had is how do we deal with the borderlessness of the internet and also the anonymity, because the anonymous nature, like where we were using pseudonyms, in the Kenyan case where we've seen and where we have some examples is that when you attack the people in power and go online using pseudonyms or anonymity, then they also clear you without letting anybody know that they've done that. And we've actually lost some bloggers. Up to today, we don't know where they went. So they use the same anonymous nature of your posting against you by then clearing you without anybody knowing where you've gone to.
Sheila Dallas Katzman is the president of the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and TV. She thinks in terms of both inside and outside strategies.
You can talk to Facebook. IWRT has three representatives at the United Nations, and the late Catherine D. White, rest her soul, was able to bring Facebook, Twitter, Google, and have them train civil society organizations on the use of these social media platforms. So, we could invite Facebook representatives or whomever, and they will come. So, it's not that we can't get them. We must invite them and discuss with them what these problems are, because they don't even understand cultures. Look at Twitter. In Thailand, the names are so long that it's so difficult for people in Thailand to put out Twitter messages. And I want to ask you this. Do you think we can boycott Facebook? Yeah, no. Do you think we should do that as women? Let's do that. Let's call for a day of action and shut it down for a day. Women across the world, we can do that.
For more about the International Association of Women in Radio and TV, visit the website iawrt.org. In Amsterdam, I'm Mindy Ran.
To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Thank you to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering.
Whoa, that's a full rainbow. All the way. Double rainbow. Oh my God. It's a double rainbow all the way. Whoa, that's so intense. Whoa, man. Whoa. 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 Whoa! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God! Woo! Oh my! Wow! Woo! Yeah! Oh my! Oh my! Oh my God! Look at that! It's starting to even look like a triple rainbow. Oh my God, it's full on. Double rainbow all the way across the sky. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Some people are losing.
What does this mean? Oh. Oh my God. Oh. Oh God. It's so bright. Oh my God. So bright and vivid. Oh. Oh. Oh.
Can't chop yet, kill it yet. So I'm in the rifle a beat and stone, yeah. Beat hard, real hard, yeah. Make boy bleed hard, yeah. Kill man, yeah. I'm a pretty slick ass, yeah. Be man, yeah. Them free that we bad, yeah.